adult issue. Nevertheless, the charter schools, which supplanted most of the old Orleans Parish system, have been an unparalleled success. Students are graduating at higher rates. The dropout rates are lower. The number of failing schools has dwindled to 7% from a pre-Katrina peak of nearly 60%. Before Katrina, the achievement gap between African-American children in the city, the kids people said couldn't learn, and white youngsters in schools in the suburbs and the rural areas was more than 25 points. Now that gap has been nearly closed. Today, nearly every student attends a public charter school, and families who used to have only one choice for their kids can now apply to nearly every school in the city. In New Orleans, geography no longer defines a kid's destiny. We've raised the bar across the board, insisting that schools serve every child. Because in New Orleans, we know that every child can learn and every child has a right to a great education. Early in my life, Dr. Norman Francis drilled into me how important an education was to helping kids, particularly young African American kids, succeed in communities like New Orleans. Having a shot at an excellent education, despite your race or socioeconomic status, is the real way to level a playing field that is still unbalanced by the legacy of Jim Crow. Before Katrina, the high school graduation rate hovered around 50%. Now, almost three-quarters of our kids are graduating on time, with more kids enrolling in college than ever before. One of these New Orleans high school graduates is a young man named Jiren Isaac. A few years ago, he wasn't going to pass the 10th grade, let alone go to college. His mom and dad sold drugs, both went to prison. As you can imagine, he struggled, but he enrolled in a charter school with a special focus on college. This made the pivotal difference. As Jiren said, open quote, "In life, you have two choices, to be defeated or to conquer. I choose to conquer," close quotes. In 2010, Jiren enrolled at Morehouse College, one example of the very real impacts the new system of schools is having. That's not to say we are close to perfect. Poverty is a huge deterrent to many children, but we are forging pathways for those who learn to find the new plateau. Along with the schools, healthcare is crucial. A dozen years ago, if a kid without a regular doctor or insurance had an earache, his mom faced a 13-hour wait at the charity hospital emergency room just to get it checked out. In the last 8 years, we established a network of neighborhood health clinics with federal support. Dr. Karen DeSalvo, the New Orleans Health Commissioner, guided this process as a precursor to the Affordable Care Act and later became President Obama's Acting Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services. The St. Thomas Community Health Center, as an example, handles everything from chronic disease management to pediatrics, with a special focus on women's health, conducting thousands of mammograms every year. Neighborhood health centers like St. Thomas serve 59,000 patients across the city every year, reducing the overload and expense at hospital emergency rooms. Two major hospitals are going up in the city, a Veterans Administration hospital and adjacent to it, the University Medical Center, part of the LSU system. The city's pre-Katrina Big Four public housing projects were decaying, crime-ridden horrors that hardly gave the poor what they needed or what they deserved. These complexes were demolished in the Reagan administration. With HUD support, we invested more than $1 billion in public housing, creating over 14,000 affordable rental units for low-income families. We've emphasized building homes close to schools, healthcare, and transit. We can see the difference it's made already at the former St. Bernard development, now known as Columbia Park. The St. Bernard was one of the old public housing developments first built by the Roosevelt administration during the Depression. It had crumbled over the years. By the time Katrina hit, 25% of the 1,300 units were empty and the area was known for its violence. And then the levees broke. And as the sun rose the day after the storm passed, the St. Bernard development was 10 feet underwater. We resolved to build back the St. Bernard, not as it once was, but as it ideally should have been. Now, Columbia Park is a mixed-income public housing neighborhood that embraces public-private partnerships. The master plan for the neighborhood includes newly built schools, an early childhood learning center, a recreation facility, a library, playgrounds, retail stores, and green space, and the crime rate has plunged. With such historic poverty, New Orleans still has many disparities, some of them glaring. But as we enter 2018, the tricentennial of our founding, New Orleans is a far better city than it has been in my lifetime, and a remarkable American comeback story. Rebuilding the city has been the most rewarding experience of my career in public life, second only to the happiness of raising a family with Cheryl. The best impulses of America show themselves when people work hard, dream of something better, and come together to make it happen. At times in the last 8 years, I was jarred by the scope of neglect and damage. My head and my heart told me that nothing is broken here or in America that cannot be repaired, no problem that cannot be solved. The road is long, it takes sacrifice, and it is often painful. But we can get there. We can rebuild the city that so many of us dreamed New Orleans could be had we gotten it right the first time. To do that, we had to be honest about our past and look to the future. And as every parent knows, you can only be as happy as your saddest child. The shadow story of my city's stirring comeback is the price we pay in the horrific loss of human life through gun violence, most of which erupts in the poorest parts of town. In America, we've become anesthetized to the pace of such homicides. One more numbing 30 seconds on the nightly news, much less the mass shootings that at times seem like some curse that our religious leaders cannot explain. Any politician venturing into this terrain risks being derided as a soft liberal, a knee-jerk on gun control, or some dewy-eyed idealist pining for a world where people behave well and all children are safe. Fine. I absolutely want a city and a country where children are safe. Yet, as the mayor of every large municipality knows, the first law of governing is pragmatism, forging a balance between what we must do to foster growth and accepting the limits of what we cannot do. The question for me is how we change those limits. My cell phone hums all hours of the day. Michael Harrison, the chief of police, sends me a text each time someone is killed. I try to visit the crime scenes and comfort the families who have lost their young. It is the most excruciating task I have as mayor. The names follow me. Ricky Summers, Brianna Allen, Shawana Pierce, Jeremy Galman, Kiera Holmes, Marcus McNeil, Daryl Holloway. All were human beings who were shot and killed on the streets of New Orleans in my time as mayor, and these are only a handful of the hundreds who died while I was in office. Some names haunt me, track me, sneak in and out of my dreams. Others, from further back in the past, stay with me for their own reasons. James Darby, Michael Norfleet, Joseph Norfleet. Senseless deaths, senseless quarrels, bullets that halted lives that deserved America's promise. If it is true that one person can change the world, it must be true that the absence of so many must change it as well. In my 8 years as mayor, the hardest day was May 29, 2012, when 5-year-old Brianna Allen died. It was her cousin Kennard's 10th birthday, and they were celebrating on their grandmother's front porch, balloons, streamers, music. I remember my childhood birthday parties. One year I got a pair of cowboy boots. Another one brought a pair of big old boxing gloves, standard cake and ice cream. Nothing was standard about the party where Brianna was shot through her tiny midsection by an AK-47 bullet. She fell into the arms of her father, Brunel, who held her as she died. Brunel was the intended target, a lifetime member of the notorious Allen family gang. During the party, two guys from the 3NG gang rounded the corner and saw Brunel on the porch. They didn't care that he was standing in the middle of small children, old folks, aunts, uncles, and friends. They let it rip. One bullet found Brianna's gut. Game over. Another bullet grazed her cousin Kennard on the neck. A third bullet traveled 300 yards down the street, crashed through a windshield, and exploded in Shawana Nani Pierce's head. Pierce, a young single mother of three boys, Kelby, Colby, and Cody, had just turned the corner on her way to return a rental car after leaving a son's graduation party. Just like that, gone. The son baked the shocked crowd at the party. Brianna's grandmother screamed in agony. The police tape stretched for blocks, flapping in the summer wind. 23 rounds fired, 5 people hit, 2 dead. In some neighborhoods, this is another day on the streets of America. As Brianna's father held her tiny head in his hands, the blood pooled on the porch beneath birthday balloons, life seeping out of her, another loss, another wound in the city. Even as people gasped and mourned, the killings found other streets and fresh victims. I had already made stopping the homicides a priority of my administration. But on that day, a counteroffensive to gun violence became my number one consuming focus. I have often said that I didn't choose this. This crisis grabbed me. And today it remains my morning coffee and my nighttime prayer. I pray that we can turn our culture from one of death and violence into one of peace and life. I've kept a photo of Lil Bri Bri, as they call her, in my office since that time. Her smiling face stares at me as a reminder of why this work is important. It is critical to my city and our country's future. What happens to the lives left behind? Brianna's father was soon arrested for another murder. He is now serving life behind bars. Brianna's uncle would be dead within a year, ambushed by 2 men with assault rifles. The true epilogue to this terrible story is actually prologue for the future of New Orleans. It is about little Kennard Allen. It was his birthday party that was interrupted by gunfire. He was hit in the neck that day, but for the grace of God, Kennard survived, although he could not escape the violence all around him. 5 months later, Kennard's father was fatally stabbed by his stepmother, and then, nearly a year to the day of his cousin Brianna's death, Kennard was again caught in the crossfire, this time shot in the cheek, along with 18 others at a Mother's Day parade. Twice, this boy came within inches of getting his head blown off. We expect little kids like Kennard to soldier on, stand on their own 2 feet. Is that the best we can do? Could you or I bounce back, move on? His other scars run deep, but are not yet visible to us. We have seen this all before. Why is the political will missing to respond with a countermeasure, a policy, as a civilized people should? Let me take you back to another Mother's Day, this time 1994. Families were picnicking at A.L. Davis Park in Central City. 9-year-old James Darby was playing a pickup football game. A little girl got elbowed in the face during a fracas. She went home in tears. Her father had left the family. Her older brother, Joseph Norfleet, 19, the man of the house, was that day drunk and high. He saw his sister's black eye and flew into a rage. Egged on by an older stepbrother, he grabbed a shotgun and jumped in a car. It was a short trip back to A.L. Davis Park. Joseph stuck his shotgun out the window and shot into the crowd, aiming for someone else in the Darby family, but instead hitting James in the head, killing him instantly. 9 years old. Just a few weeks earlier, James Darby had written President Clinton, "Dear Mr. Clinton, I want you to stop the killing in the city. People is dead, and I think that somebody might kill me. So would you please stop the people from deading? I'm asking you nicely to stop it. I know you can do it. Do it. I know you could. Your friend, James." We use that overused word tragic to describe terrible events. And in this case, for tragedy at both ends of the gun. The pain and agony of losing not one child, but 2. James died and was buried in cold ground. And Joseph, 19, lit up and showing a child's bullying bravado in what he did, went to the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola for the rest of his life. Several years ago, I went to see him in Angola. It was surreal. He spoke of the day he now regrets. He spoke of having been shot twice in his life on the rough streets of New Orleans before that day. We are left to wonder what might have been. As the years pass, we talk about violence just as, quote-unquote, part of the culture. Each murder becomes one small part of some impossibly large whole. I am haunted by the lives we could not save. The river of federal funds that allowed me to rebuild this city provided no levee system against the tides of violence sprung from the poorest gun laws of this country. I have no power to stop the flow of guns. The criminal justice system can only arrest and incarcerate the worst offenders. In the face of futile gun laws, I decided to raise awareness and set an alternative path. We have made a significant dent, but it is only that, a dent. We have so much more work to do. I firmly believe that this is a solvable problem if we treat gun violence as both a public safety issue and a public health crisis. We vaccinate people to thwart disease. Against gun violence, society is passive. A politician learns from youngsters trapped on the front lines of this carnage how desperately they want to avoid drug gangs and change their circumstances. Ricky Summers, 16, was surrounded by violence in his Central City neighborhood. Ricky was determined to get out and be different. He was one of the original Kipsters, enrolled in the first class at Knowledge is Power program in Central City, part of the charter school effort. With ambitions for college, Ricky was struggling to become a man without the guiding hand of a father. His eighth grade English class had been studying Langston Hughes's poem, Harlem. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or does it explode? Ricky was in his school uniform when they found him behind a blighted house, shot in the back. Ricky's dream was violently denied, his rich potential snuffed out like too many before him. What must we do to save young men like Ricky Summers? Not too far from Brianna Allen's photo are stacks of red binders in my office. They hold the stories of murder victims in my city, more than 1,000 of them since I took office in 2010. Emotions overflow at funeral services, another prayer vigil, a moment of silence, an endless cycle, primarily young African-American men killing each other. In 2011, 5 John McDonough High School students were killed before they had a chance to make their mark on the world. It is a sad, horrifying truth that in 2011, a John McDonough High student was more likely to be killed on New Orleans streets than a soldier fighting in Afghanistan. Let that sink in. Statistics confirm that 80% of the victims know one another. Most of the quote-unquote beefs or disputes are so petty as to leave us numb over the waste of human life. Day after day, young men kill someone they know, and not just in New Orleans. They are not faceless, nameless thugs who die out of sight and out of mind. They are flesh and blood. They matter. Their deaths are not God's will. Often, as I have tried to focus attention on this issue, many people, not just whites, turn away. Not my problem. Just thugs killing thugs. They get what they deserve. It's not my fault. One of the biggest sticks that was used against me in taking down monuments was that I should be focused on murder, not monuments. Not one of those people helped me in fighting murder or helping young black men in my time at City Hall. And my record on murder reduction is unlike any other administration. But the opponents to taking down the monuments used any excuse they possibly could. The great civil rights activist and Congressman John Lewis refused to stand aside, asking, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? Our battlefield is on the street and in the heart. The mass shootings in churches, schools, movie theaters, and malls are the opposite face of the same coin. Too many guns, too little preventive intervention. This is a mental health issue, a security issue, and the greatest moral issue in America today. Where are the voices of our religious leaders calling down the failure of legislators and governments to face this blight? If this is not a pro-life issue, what on God's earth is it? Since at least the early 1970s, major urban centers have experienced gunfire like warfare. Every year, nearly 15,000 people are murdered on American soil. About 40 people lost every 24 hours. In Las Vegas, before the horrific massacre from the hotel window of people attending a country music concert, a life went down to gun violence on average once a day. That bears repeating. In most major cities, someone dies each day from a gunshot. The weapon of choice, most often a handgun. The victims and perpetrators, disproportionately young African-American men. As former Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter has so forcefully said, if a foreign enemy killed 15,000 American citizens, there would be hell to pay. If the Ku Klux Klan murdered thousands of young black men, this nation would be in an uproar. But for some reason, we are hardened to the domestic gun deaths and remain eerily silent. Maybe it is in slow motion. We refuse to hear it or see it because we place too little value on the lives of young black men. This humanitarian crisis is not in some far-off nation, but here on our streets, in our neighborhoods, in our homes. America cannot be strong abroad if we are under attack at home. Morally, economically, and for the good of this nation's strength and security, we must change this hideous situation. It is wrong for police officers to patrol streets in crime-ridden areas at a disadvantage in weapons. As president of the United States Conference of Mayors, I work with my colleagues in proposing policies to increase mental health facilities, reduce prison terms for nonviolent offenders, and broaden programs to reach at-risk youth. We want to limit the guns and strengthen the rules about who can buy them and what they can buy. We must get Congress to address the cadaver in the living room, as Republican and Democratic mayors, police chiefs, and law enforcement officials have done. From 1980 to 2012, a total of 626,000 people, a disproportionate number of them African American men, were murdered in America. That's more citizens lost to murder in 32 years than all of our servicemen killed during World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Persian Gulf War, the wars in Iraq, and Afghanistan, combined. I refuse to accept that America is so callous about human life. This must stop. The response in Congress has been tepid because of the racial dynamics. Most of the victims are young blacks, not part of the Republican base, not worth the risk of offending the powerful National Rifle Association. People are scared to speak up. Or perhaps as a nation we have bought into an evil notion that the lives of the mostly young African American men killed every day have less value and thus don't deserve our urgent attention. Instead of grappling with this problem, we desperately look for quick fixes and want to quote-unquote get tough. More prisons, more guards, more guns. But history tells us that will just make things worse. We can't imprison our way out of this problem. America has more people incarcerated than more than a dozen other countries combined. And many nations with fewer people in prison have less crime and lower murder rates. Since the early 1980s, the number of incarcerated people in the United States has increased more than fourfold, going from less than 500,000 to about 2.2 million people today. That increase is more than double the rate of inflation over the same period. In Louisiana alone, since 1990, the population in prison has more than doubled, from about 19,000 to about 40,000 today. That leaves about 1 in 86 adults in our state incarcerated, with nearly half serving sentences for nonviolent, mostly drug-related offenses. America spends about $70 billion every year on corrections, roughly on par with the budget for the entire Department of Education. Indeed, on average, public schools spend about $12,000 to $13,000 per pupil per year. To incarcerate one person for 1 year cost about $30,000, depending on the state. In two decades, Louisiana went from spending about $275 million on incarceration to $750 million today. Remember Joseph Norfleet? The state will spend several million dollars keeping him behind bars for life. And Louisiana's violent crime rate is higher now than it was in 1977. I have seen it up close, standing over the body of a young African-American boy, gunned down like a dog, lying on the street, eyes wide open, tongue protruding, lifeless. You stare and think, this should not be. You look paralyzed at the police officer in the operating room of our trauma unit, a gunshot to the head. You think this should never be. I have seen more than I want to see. But once you've seen something, you can't unsee it. I attend as many funerals as I can. The city owes the family some presents, a sign that we grieve with them, knowing things aren't right. It is hard beyond words to put yourself close to a family shattered by violent loss. It is a duty I will not miss when I am not mayor. But in fulfilling this responsibility, I have come to see that whether mother or father, son or daughter, grief is not filtered by whether the deceased was a police officer, an innocent child, or a young man with a rap sheet, quote-unquote, in the life. When you're standing at the casket and hear the sobs and feel the heartache around you, the distant cries of Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter fade as you realize that we are all losers in this culture of violence. This is a problem that can be fixed. It requires a national holistic policy in public health, not unlike our efforts to contain Ebola or our newfound recognition that the opioid epidemic needs a sweeping commitment to mental health and substance abuse treatment. Treating the cause and not just the symptom is important. It was not done in the 1980s and 90s when we locked up mostly African-American crack cocaine users and threw away the key. We had a, quote-unquote, war on drugs. Quote-unquote, they were criminals and had to be dealt with by the justice system, political leaders argued. But yet today, with a mostly white face on the opioid crisis in the Rust Belt and the Northeast, we're talking in much more holistic public health terms. There is empathy and compassion for those with addiction. Policymakers today talk about destigmatizing drug addiction. Police are being trained to administer Narcan, a drug that saves the lives of those overdosing. Those are good changes, but I worry about the lingering effects of the old mentality. Black men and women are still in prison for drug possession charges decades ago, and so the cycle continues. And so you might ask, with so much urban warfare in the poorest streets, how have we responded as a nation? Even little kids can tell you, and I quote, out here, it is kill or be killed. That cold, that simple. Yet for too many Americans, this reality may as well be on another planet. Murder and violence are the poisonous fruit grown from the soil of injustice, racism, and inequality, fertilized by guns, drugs, alcohol, and disintegrated families. Hope fades. Hate grows. People feel they have nothing to lose. To those who say it has always been this way, I answer, we made this problem by neglect. We can be proactive and fix it. All of this happens in the shadows of the statues, whose message has always been, as Terrence Blanchard said, African Americans are less than. Every murder leaves a wake of destruction, the collateral damage of gunshots. An innocent child loses a father, a mother's heart is broken. A family is sent reeling into an abyss. But the endings don't have to be entirely bleak. Consider Leonard Gaumann. Leonard's father was killed on the streets of New Orleans when he was 4. His 17-year-old mother was alone. As Leonard moved through school, he found a path in the recovery school district that led him to Cohen College Prep, a charter school. With the help of his teachers, Leonard applied to colleges and universities. He was accepted to Yale University with a full scholarship. Leonard's story made the front page of the press, and more articles and editorials followed. He was honored by the city council and the state legislature. Congratulations and donations flooded in from across the city. He showed the determination to find a way. He had good help, which is what many more young African American men on the bitter edge need in order to turn themselves around. They, too, can do great things with the right support and guidance. Those of us who had easy paths to education should realize how steep the odds are for first-generation college students. Only 1 in 10 who start college actually graduate. With hats off to Leonard Gaumann, I look forward to the day when it will not be front-page news when a young African-American from New Orleans is accepted by Yale because so many others followed in Leonard's path. Imagine with me, 2 children, representing the hundreds of kids living on opposite sides of oak-lined St. Charles Avenue, the famous street with the streetcar tracks. They live a few blocks away from each other, but a world apart in every other sense. In Central City, a boy named James, 14, goes to public school. He lives on 7th Street with his mom and 2 younger brothers, a few blocks downriver from St. Charles Avenue. A 1-bedroom apartment in a long, thin, run-down building. Every morning, James's mom catches the 5:30 a.m. bus to a downtown hotel. She won't get back from her second job as a security guard until 9 that night. James gets home from school. Not much is going on in the afternoon. As the sun sets, James is restless, hangs with his friends at his corner. His mom tries her best, but the drugs, easy money, and guns are everywhere. And most of the time, no one's at home to help him resist the lure of the street. One day, James's mom finds a pistol under his bed. Imagine young James, in tears, telling her the same thing I have heard from kids just as young. It's for protection. Again, I hear, Mayor, out here, it's either kill or be killed. Meanwhile, four blocks on the upriver side of St. Charles, at a home in the Garden District, another 14-year-old, Mike, goes to private school. The family lives in a large four-bedroom house. Mom is a lawyer, Dad's in finance. They're good people working long hours downtown, but the nanny is home for Mike when school lets out, unless he's at practice for the tennis, football, or basketball teams, or stays for the chess club or quiz bowl practice. Every night, the family eats dinner. Mom and Dad make sure he does his homework. Mike in the Garden District hopes to follow in his dad's footsteps. James in Central City, his dad's in Angola Prison. On Mardi Gras, the two boys head to St. Charles Avenue, drawn by the exotic splendor of the Zulu King, the beauty of the Rex Parade, the backbeat of St. Augustine Purple Knights Marching 100, the bounce of Al Johnson's voice singing Carnival Time in a truck parade. James watches from the lakeside of St. Charles, Mike from the riverside. For a brief moment, they occupy the same world, hearts beating to the same rhythm, catching beads and dancing in the same street. In between floats as kids play in the street, perhaps they meet or reach for the same pair of beads, joined in the synthesis of time, geography, culture, race, and music, all shared, touching the same reality, things they both want, perfect symmetry for one moment in time. But when the parade ends, they go back to their lives on different sides of St. Charles Avenue, to different worlds. In James's Central City, the average household income is less than $36,000. In Mike's world, in the Garden District, the average household income exceeds $128,000. In Central City, 69% of households are run by a single parent, mostly a mother. In the Garden District, only 3% are single-parent households. In Central City, people are twice as likely to rent rather than own, five times as likely not to have a vehicle. To make ends meet, the mom, earning minimum wage, must work day and night, typically two jobs. Latchkey kids wait hours for mom to come home. Since 2010, Central City has seen more than 300 shootings. Walk a few blocks away, it is a different world. There were only two shooting victims in the Garden District over the last 7 years. Think again about 14-year-olds, James and Mike, each walking home that Mardi Gras night. For James, as on many nights in Central City, NOPD searched the area after a shooting. Witnesses say it was a young black man in a hoodie. Cops, already on edge, see James with his hood up and pull toward him fast and close. James jerks his hand out of his pocket. He's holding a black cell phone. Will the police know that? Sometimes this is how tragedies happen. And for young men like James, the margin of error between life and death is razor thin. If we replace James with Mike from the Garden District, the difference in that margin of error would likely allow Mike to live. These same two neighborhoods produced Joseph Norfleet and Peyton Manning. They're about the same age and may have played on the same football team at the nearby A.L. Davis playground some 30 years ago. Imagine them meeting in some football scrimmage and then going their separate ways. One on a pipeline to prison, the other to NFL prosperity. Some people are cynical and say we cannot change. I believe we can. The great part of being American is that we believe in endless horizons, that for every problem there is a solution, that no breach or divide cannot be repaired. I have hope because of young people like Leonard Galman. Out of despair, hope rises. Leonard went to Yale because hope was his compass. In 2012, we launched a program called NOLA for Life with the stated agenda of reducing homicide and giving youngsters on the margins activity and structure as our budget allowed. We asked police officers, mothers of murder victims, criminologists, focus groups with young men in the life, how we can reduce this problem. Can we find a strategy worth applying on a greater level? Each group told us essentially the same things. Solutions for prevention have to be visible on the streets. You have to change a lot in a given culture to reduce murders when killing is so widespread. More jobs, good schools, healthy neighborhoods, stronger families, a better police department all play a pivotal role. We also learned that murders happen in small groups of young African American men who hang out together. The same profile emerges time and again. Roughly one in three murders happens in the same four neighborhoods, and 80% of the victims are young black males. Many are high school dropouts and unemployed. 80% had an arrest record. More than half of them are under 29, and close to 80% of the murderers knew their victims. After talking to young men who fit the profile, we learn that they want to get out of the life. We go to those young men doing violence and we literally sit them down and say, quote, "We value you. We love you. Put down the gun and we can help you. If you don't, we will take action to protect the city," close quote. Sometimes the opportunity to make a change helps us get someone on the right track. I think about one young man who dealt drugs, carried a gun, ran with a crew. When he got involved with NOLA for Life, he came with two of his partners. Before the end of the year, one of them would be arrested for murder, and the other would be shot dead. But he chose a new way. With our help, he got a job, worked hard, and has been promoted. He got off the streets and into a local community college. He's building a life for himself and his young children. The other piece to this murder prevention strategy is a local, state, and federal multi-agency gang unit. They have targeted over 14 violent groups, gotten 150 individuals indicted, and by using RICO racketeering statutes, put dozens of gang members behind bars. The message we send to those terrorizing our neighborhoods is, you have a choice. Stop the shooting. Put down your gun. We will help you get on the right path, or we're coming for you. We don't have all the answers, but we're focused on supporting young men who turn away from the violence. With Michael Nutter and several philanthropic foundations, we started Cities United, which brings together mayors from across the country to address the violence among African-American men. Ceasefire New Orleans seeks to stop the cycle of violence by mediating conflicts. Hundreds of youth from the toughest New Orleans neighborhoods come out for midnight basketball to play, learn from role models, and get connected to a chance for jobs and job training. We're working hard to help ex-offenders get their life back on track with programs like Cafe Reconcile. This piece is really important to break the cycle. A third of the million prisoners released each year will go back to jail within 3 years. Now, we can wait until they commit another crime, or we can anticipate their needs and meet them partway with job training, counseling, and employment offices. We've got to shut this revolving door. It is outrageous that 1 in 14 black men is behind bars, and 1 in 7 is either in prison, on parole, or on probation. To fight violent crime and murder, we can't ignore the social dysfunction that causes it. New Orleans has become a laboratory for social change, with promising results. We've launched an aggressive post-incarceration reentry strategy, a program that reaches out within 72 hours of release from prison and connect ex-inmates with a workforce reentry program of services and jobs. Murder is at a historic quarter-century low. That is not easy for people to believe when the nightly news reports so much killing. I am not blaming the news media for doing their job. We still have too many murders, but we keep searching for the truth about city streets and how to stop the worst of it. We have a long way to go, but how far we have come. I want historians who look back on this time to write about the people who met that terrible crisis of human rights in America and did what was just and decent to make the fundamental changes to uphold life in the poorest streets. The lives of children depend on it. Jefferson's words, "All men are created equal," require a constant evaluation of ourselves. Until every life matters, including black lives, we won't be able to plant seeds of hope in beleaguered neighborhoods and fulfill America's lofty promises. I believe that we are bound together as one people, indivisible, with one shared destiny. We cannot allow young black men to feel forsaken. We must go forward together, or not at all. We must press on, share the agenda that the culture of homicides is evil and unacceptable, and resolve ourselves to changing it, however long it may take or incremental it may be. But to do so requires us to value every life. The monuments hover and tell a different story. The shadow these symbols cast is oppressive. It is in this broad context that people must now understand that the monuments and the reasons they were erected were intended not to affirm life, but to deny life. And in that sense, the monuments, in a way, are murder. Chapter 6, The Shadow of Robert E. Lee. A re-election campaign reflects what voters think of the job you have done in the preceding years. In 2014, I won a second term, prevailing handily over two opponents, earning 64% in the primary. We had scores of construction projects underway, extensive repair of streets and subsurface piping, and though crime was on many minds, not least my own, we were making headway in giving black boys from broken streets a path to hope with the resources available. Homicide rates were trending down significantly, though one killing is too many, as my cell phone reminded me all hours of the night. I felt rising hope for the city's future despite the shadow cast by my predecessor, Ray Nagin, who was convicted on federal charges of bribery, wire fraud, and tax evasion and sentenced to 10 years in prison, the first mayor in New Orleans history so prosecuted. Nevertheless, we had come far in the major rebuilding to make New Orleans better functioning and more livable since Katrina. It had been 9 years since 80% of the neighborhoods were submerged. I focused on keeping our construction work on time, on task, and under budget, if possible. The city charter prohibits a third consecutive term for mayor. I wanted to leave a city truly transformed at the end of my 8th year. By chance, 2018 would mark the city's tricentennial. I felt the 300th anniversary would provide a rare opportunity to showcase the post-Katrina resurrection and highlight revitalized neighborhoods and the array of the resurgent music, restaurants, and artistic culture. Despite the city's traumatic racial history, New Orleans had a growing international image as the birthplace of jazz and the home of a rich African-American culture. In asking civic leaders to form a tricentennial commission, I spoke at length with James Carville and Walter Isaacson. I solicited ideas from both of them and reached out to Wynton Marsalis. Most people think of Wynton Marsalis as a jazz musician. I consider Wynton Marsalis a force of nature. We had gone to different high schools, but knew each other in passing back then. Wynton was barely 20 when his first album was released and set him on his path as a prolific recording artist. He received the Pulitzer Prize for Distinguished Musical Composition, and he guided the establishment of Jazz at Lincoln Center, which he serves as artistic director. Like his father, Wynton has a commitment to teaching, taking time on his concert tours to lead countless workshops for students. Wynton Marsalis also reads more than most people I know. In the conversations we've had over the years, I came away impressed by his astute sense of history. Though he lives in New York, I wanted his ideas on the tricentennial planning, and I wanted to get his commitment to perform as we developed our schedule of events. I also would bend his ear whenever I could on using art as a tool in our fight against violence. As an artist and historian, I wanted him to curate the tricentennial year in the same way you would art in a museum. I don't think this was asking for much, and in return, I got something for which I never bargained. Wynton had a concert in New Orleans not long after my re-election and agreed to a tricentennial chat. We met at Starbucks, downtown on Convention Center Boulevard, near his hotel. In the amiable way of one native son to another, I gave a verbal sketch of my plans for the 300th anniversary year and asked him to help. "I'll do it, but there's something I'd like you to do," he said. What's that? Take down the Robert E. Lee statue. You lost me on that. I don't like the fact that Lee Circle is named Lee Circle. Why is that? Well, let me help you see it through my eyes. Who is he? What does he represent? And in that most prominent space in the city of New Orleans, does that space reflect who we were, who we want to be, or who we are? Suddenly, I was listening. Louis Armstrong left and never came back. He didn't even want to be buried in his hometown, he continued. You ever think about what Robert E. Lee means to someone black? Black and white people watch carnival parades there, I said. He responded, a big reason so many black people left New Orleans is they didn't feel welcome. You ever think of that African-American diaspora? I indeed knew that black people had been leaving for decades to seek better opportunities. Still, the city had a 60% African-American majority. In rebuilding neighborhoods post-flood, I was trying to foster a better-made and more welcoming city. As he spoke of the symbolic weight of Confederate monuments, Marcellus blindsided me. That would be one big political fight, Winton. And then he just simply said, yeah, man, but it's the right thing to do. You should think about it. My head was spinning. I need to find a way to tell Winton why I can't do this. The legislature or Congress will try to stop me. This would be a huge political fight. I wasn't sure the juice was worth the squeeze. But as my wheels kept spinning, the idea of state or federal authorities blocking a mayor on an initiative in his city troubled me. Who controlled the monument? NOPD would respond to any threat to public order at the park or the monument itself, city services, city money. As a lawyer, I wanted to know who owned the Robert E. Lee Monument. As mayor, I wanted to know how the statue went up, who owned the land, where did authority lie. New Orleans has a home rule charter. Founded by the French in 1718, the city shifted to Spanish colonial rule in the 1760s, reverted briefly to France in 1803, and a year later, with a Louisiana Purchase, the city, older than America, became the U.S. territory of Orleans. Louisiana achieved statehood in 1812. As one of the oldest cities in the state, the city's home rule charter provided for local autonomy on certain issues that the state or federal government could not easily preempt. My curiosity was mounting about Lee Circle. I sent a researcher to the main branch of the public library, two blocks from City Hall across Duncan Plaza, for copies of relevant documents from the department that houses the city archives. Before the Lee statue was erected in 1884, I learned, the space had been called Place du Tivoli for nearly half a century, after the beautiful spaces in Italy outside of Rome and in Paris. In fact, in one of my favorite finds in my research, Tivoli Circle, as it was also known, had been the site of a Union camp in 1864. Although the Lee icon has a commanding presence, Lee himself had virtually no ties to the city. Some records reflect that he visited New Orleans once, very briefly, before the war. He sacrificed a promising military career in the United States Army to become general of the Confederate troops. He led the fight to destroy the Union for the purpose of maintaining slavery. I learned that New Orleans was the largest slave market in America. Fortunes were made in the antebellum era by people who used slaves as collateral for bank loans and thought little of sundering families at the auction to make a profit. In reviewing the documents my staff had researched, I was intrigued by the historical summary I found in a form for the National Register of Historic Places, which had been filed in 1999 to secure status for the equestrian statue of General Beauregard at the small circle outside City Park. The United States Department of the Interior, through the National Park Service, oversees applications for historic status. The document called the statue Beauregard, open quote, one of three major Louisiana monuments representing what is known by historians as the Cult of the Lost Cause, close quote. Cult of the Lost Cause. Cult. The definition of cult, from the Merriam-Webster Learner's Dictionary, is a small religious group that is not part of a larger and more accepted religion and that has beliefs regarded by many people as extreme or dangerous. A situation in which people admire and care about something or someone very much or too much. A small group of very devoted supporters or fans. Close quote. I knew from my experiences with two Department of Interior facilities, Jean Lafitte Park, south of the city in Barataria, and the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park, that the uniformed rangers were well-read men and women, enriching the lectures and tours they gave. For the Jazz Park, they had conducted extensive oral histories of musicians to gain insight for their presentations, educational materials, and programming ideas. The narrative for the National Register of Historic Places application reflected similarly high research standards. The cult of the lost cause had its roots in the Southern search for justification and the need to find a substitute for victory in the Civil War. In attempting to deal with defeat, Southerners created an image of the war as a great, heroic epic. A major theme of the cult of the lost cause was the clash of two civilizations, one inferior to the other. The North, open quote, invigorated by constant struggle with nature, had become materialistic, grasping for wealth and power, close quote. The South had a, open quote, more generous climate, close quote, which had led to a finer society based upon, open quote, veracity and honor in man, chastity and fidelity in women, close quote. Like tragic heroes, Southerners had waged a noble but doomed struggle to preserve their superior civilization. There was an element of chivalry in the way the South had fought, achieving noteworthy victories against staggering odds. This was the lost cause, as the late 19th century saw it, and a whole generation of Southerners set about glorifying and celebrating it. As I read more about the lost cause, I was shocked to realize how much I had not learned about the war between the states, which is what they called it in courses when I was growing up. The idea, made pervasive by lost cause adherents, that the war had never been about slavery, but defending regional integrity, shaped the twisted logic of retaliation against African Americans in Reconstruction, culminating in the 1890s, when Louisiana, during a wave of white violence, deprived most blacks of the right to vote. Lynchings became almost commonplace across the South. In a 2015 Washington Post op-ed, James W. Lowen, a retired University of Vermont sociology professor and the author of Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong, notes, and I quote, "The Confederates won with the pen and the noose what they could not win on the battlefield, the cause of white supremacy and the dominant understanding of what the war was all about. We are still digging ourselves out from under the misinformation they spread, which is manifested in our public monuments and our history books. The resulting mythology took hold of the nation a generation later and persists, which is why a presidential candidate can suggest, as Michelle Bachmann did in 2011, that slavery was somehow pro-family, and why the public, per the Pew Research Center, believes that the war was fought mainly over states' rights. The bigotry shaped by that myth was hardwired into the thinking of many Southern whites, as I discovered growing up, a century after the Civil War. Moon the coon, your daddy ruined this city. A generation later, David Duke ran four statewide campaigns in Louisiana, even as journalists traced the web of ties to Nazis in his past. Although he lost by huge margins, he won a white majority, suggesting how easily they bought into the role of victims of the same federal government that provided national defense, worker safety standards, environmental safeguards, Social Security, and Medicare. Not until David Duke went to prison did his base of support measurably shrink. The power of the lost cause cult to distort history and rationalize lynching and the trampling of human rights weighed on me as we considered the legal status of the New Orleans monuments. I later learned from the work of the Southern Poverty Law Center that there were some 700 Confederate memorial monuments and statues erected well after the Civil War. According to their research, open quote, two distinct periods saw a significant rise in the dedication of monuments and other symbols. The first began around 1900 amid the period in which states were enacting Jim Crow laws to disenfranchise the newly freed African Americans and resegregate society. This spike lasted well into the 1920s, a period that saw a dramatic resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan, which had been born in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. The second spike began in the early 1950s and lasted through the 1960s, as the civil rights movement led to a backlash among segregationists. Close quotes. They still celebrate official Confederate holidays across the South. Luckily, not in Louisiana. It became clearer and clearer that the symbols were intended to send a specific message to African Americans. In New Orleans, the statues to Lee, Jefferson Davis, and P.G.T. Beauregard were the most visible manifestations of the Lost Cause cult. But the most glaring symbol was an obelisk that had been erected downtown next to a statue of Henry Clay on the Canal Street Neutral-Ground near the river in 1891. James Lowen called the Liberty Place Monument, open quote, the most overtly racist icon to white supremacy in the United States, close quote. It commemorated the revolt on September 14, 1874, by several thousand white Democrats seeking to overturn the Republican Reconstruction government. Lowen continues, and I quote, after incendiary speeches at 4 p.m, about 8,400 whites attacked 3,000 black members of the state militia, 500 mostly white members of the Metropolitan Police, and 100 other local police officers, all under the command of General James Longstreet. Longstreet had been a Confederate general. Indeed, he was Lee's senior corps commander at Gettysburg. After the war, he came to believe, in accord with the 14th and 15th Amendments, that blacks should have full rights as citizens, including voting rights. In 15 minutes, the white leaguers routed Longstreet's forces and captured him. 11 Metropolitans and their allies were killed and 60 wounded. 21 white leaguers were killed, including 2 bystanders, and 19 were wounded. White League officials then took charge of all state offices in Louisiana and appealed to President Ulysses S. Grant for recognition. The president instead sent federal troops to restore the constituted government, but the insurrection had a major impact on Congress. In 1877, Reconstruction ended. Federal troops left the occupied areas, and the defeated South unleashed a wave of terror against blacks while subjugating them to segregated schools and inferior public education without the right to vote. In 1891, the White League obelisk, that is what I wish to call it from here on, because liberty had nothing to do with the White League, was erected on the Canal Street median with the names of White League men who had died. Former Mayor William J. Behan, who arranged the installation ceremony, had himself been part of the armed revolt. This is really specious, I thought. The South lost the war, and a group of people got together and decided they were going to adorn the city with monuments that revered those who fought on behalf of a cause that was lost, which they wanted to make seem noble. They were fighting for the right to own and sell black human beings. Now, I'm a white guy from the South, through and through. But those icons are not speaking for me. Who were they speaking for? A small and very determined minority. Take an honest review of our history. The South wasn't all white. New Orleans was a huge slave market, and the city was filled with slaveholders. But we had a multicultural community even back then, including a large population of free people of color who could vote and were citizens. In fact, the city of New Orleans, from the moment of its birth, had been incredibly diverse. So who was exercising political authority? William Behan, who put up the Liberty Monument, had been a Confederate soldier. As I read more about the Lost Cause, I concluded that the statues were a lie. Their advocates had stolen the identity of New Orleans. The Civil War began in 1861, with General Beauregard of New Orleans leading the charge against Fort Sumter, a federal seaport in Charleston, South Carolina. New Orleans fell early to the Union in April 1862, and as an occupied city through the war, was not a hotbed of rebel revolts. Behan was a member of the elite Pickwick Club. The White League met at the Boston Club, which for generations had a viewing stand where Rex, the King of Mardi Gras, toasted his young queen, a debutante of the season. Boston Club members supported Behan, and in 1874 took the law into their own hands in the White League Revolt, wealthy men resorting to vigilante violence, trying to topple a Republican administration.